What we're going to talk about this morning here in Denmark, is we're going to take a look at the in-memory OLTP database engine component in SQL Server 2014. It's in the CTP 1. But this is going to be a very demo-based presentation where I'm going to show you a bit about how it's actually working. So just before we kind of start, how many of you have a pretty good idea about what is the in-memory OLTP in SQL Server 2014? It's a couple of hands. How many of you have heard about it? All right. Oh, hackathon. So most of you, that's good. All right. Cool. My name is David Peter Hansen. I'm here from Denmark, but I currently live in London. I work for Hitachi Consulting there. And my specialty is large-scale data warehousing and OLTP database solutions on SQL Server. So that's basically what I do there. You can catch me on Twitter, on DP Hansen, if you want to get in touch afterwards. You're more than welcome to just ask me questions or comments or anything, really. Just get in touch with me. You can also get in touch with me via my blog. And I'll be happy to help out, even if it's not related to this. I'm more than happy to help you guys. All right. But let's kind of get started. The in-memory OLTP is a new database engine component, which is fully integrated into SQL Server 2014, which hasn't been released yet, obviously, but we have got a CTP1 out of it. And basically what this component is that it optimizes the OLTP workload by accessing the data in-memory, hence the name, rather than have to go down and access the data on the desk. All right. So that's pretty much the, I won't go any deeper, but you can, there have been some benchmarking out there, and you can achieve quite a significant improvement in performance and in the processing time that you're having, all right? But this is just kind of an overview that came from Kalyn Delaney's white paper, just cleaned it up a bit, where you kind of have to see, and to the right side, you have the old components that you have in SQL Server. You have the buffer pool, you have the query execution, the T-SQL query execution, and so on, the parser, the catalog, the optimizer, stuff that we already know that we have had in SQL Server for many years, all right? But to the left side, you see that we have now some new components that are built into the engine. And one of those new components is the memory optimized tables and the indexes as well. The indexes as well are in memory and not stored on disk. We also have something called natively compiled stored procedures and schemas, so you can compile your stored procedures so that they actually are executing as machine code rather than some interpreted, that's a hard word, T-SQL or language in the source. So it will be faster to execute those. Then you have this query interop in the middle. And I think that's a really cool feature because basically what it means is that you from T-SQL can go down and you can access these in-memory tables via T-SQL. So you can combine the in-memory and the disk-based table in your queries. So that's pretty cool. You don't need to take your entire database and put it into in-memory. You can take part of the database and put it into memory. And I think that's a pretty cool feature, and I'm going to show you that today. It's not as fast as natively compiled stored procedures, but it's pretty cool that you actually can go that direction. You can't go the other way direction, that if you have a natively compiled stored procedure, you can't go in and access the normal disk-based tables and indexes, but you can go the other way from T-SQL and access the in-memory or the memory-optimized tables and indexes. All right. And what is really cool here, if we see in the top, is that the client application, so the user, if you're via Management Studio or via your ODBC driver or your application or whatever, you have one interface. And I think that's Microsoft really nailed it with this. I don't say that too often, but Thomas is laughing there. But I think they really did. The way that they say, okay, well, we don't want that you need to go down and access these in-memory tables using a complete new language. We don't want people to learn a new language because they're never going to adopt that. So they said, okay, well, we have this client application and we already have the TDS handler and the session management in place. Let's go down and say, okay, well, that's where we connect to the data, whether or not it's in-memory, memory-optimized tables, or disk-based tables, right? So it's kind of transparent to you. So it's not really transparent, but it's kind of transparent. I'll show that to you later on today. That whether or not you access the memory optimized tables or the disk based tables. So where are all these things stored? Normally we have the data files, the MDF and NDF files, where we store the data in them. But that's not quite the case when we talk about the memory optimized tables. Because all the data is stored in memory all the time. So you don't, when you're querying these tables, you don't go down and access the disk at all. Hence the name in memory, which makes it significantly faster than when you normally have it, despite the fact that you might have the data in the buffer pool, but the query optimizer thinks that it's probably going to be a physical read anyway. So this kind of changes the game a bit. But since memory will clear out when the box bounces, or when SQL Server restarts, or we have a disaster or something like that, we need to persist this data somewhere. And this is where SQL Server goes down and persists the data in what are called checkpoint files. And these checkpoint files, and I'll show that to you, it's only used for the recovery purpose. So when you write to your tables, when you write or update to your tables, do any changes to your tables, it goes down and append these changes to the checkpoint files. It doesn't go in and have to figure out, okay, well, it's in this table, it's probably there somewhere. It just goes down and append to it. Then there's a background process that goes in and it merges these files together so the files don't grow, because even if it's a delete, it goes in and say and just append that delete to the checkpoint file. Because these checkpoint files are only used when we start up SQL Server and it has to read all these data from the disk into memory. Otherwise, it just resists in memory. We can have a maximum number of these checkpoint files, and the maximum number is 4,000. All right? And each of these files can maximum have 128 megabyte, which gives us a theoretical maximum of 512 gigabyte. However, Microsoft says they only support up to 256 gigabyte. And you're like, wait a minute. Well, we can have terabytes and terabytes of memory in our boxes. Why is this? Well, it's probably going to change this limit, but that's the limit as we have it today in CTP1. I hope they increase the limit a little bit. But also, you don't want to use your entire memory in the box for in-memory. You might have some old data, some not hot data that you have in your OLTP application that you want to store on disk-based. So it doesn't use. You also need memory for your buffer pool, for your planned cache, for the OS, or whatever you have on the box. So I think most of the OLTP application that I see in there out there, you can take part of it and you can migrate this into the in-memory OLTP component, or to the memory-optimized tables, and while leaving other parts of the database as disk-based tables as we have it today. All right? The transaction log that it uses the same transaction log as the disk-based tables as we know it today. So whenever we go in and we insert or update to a table or delete from a table, it makes an entry into the transaction log, just like we know it today. However, that transaction is minimal log. It's not minimal log, but it uses less log bandwidth. That's my mistake. It uses less log bandwidth because it doesn't log the index operations. And also, it does not log undo records. So when SQL Server normally, it has the redo records, it has the undo records for disaster recovery when the transactions, when you do something on a transaction. But it doesn't do that when we are dealing with memory-optimized tables. All right. So at recovery time. And so I mentioned before, doing the database recovery, doing disaster recovery, all the data needs to be read from disk into memory. Kind of makes sense. That also means that's your bottleneck when you're doing disaster recovery and SQL Server boots up when you're dealing with memory optimized tables. So something to be very wary about when you're doing this. However, the checkpoint files use streaming I/O, which means it's sequential I/O that you need to cater for. That also means that the main factors becomes the speed of the sequential I/O that you're doing. Random I/O doesn't matter in this case. And also the bandwidth of your HBA on your SAN, how much data, how much throughput can we actually get through the SAN? That becomes a factor. There's no need to use SSDs for these things because SSDs is very good for, they're obviously very fast, but they're also very good for random reads and writes. And here we're just doing sequential reads. So what you actually want to do, depending on what is your recovery time objective, you want to look at, well, I only want SQL Server to be down in this amount of time when we have a disaster. All right? And that will determine the I/O speed that you need. So you shouldn't just go, well, you should obviously go out and buy the fastest spindles that you can get, 15K, 2.5 inches, or whatever you have in your SAN. But you can spread these checkpoint files across multiple LUNs on your SAN. And SQL Server will parallel load these checkpoint files into memory. So the more parallel, the more LUNs you have, where you spread these checkpoint files out, the faster SQL Server will boot up. All right. When we create a table, it's very, very similar to what you know today. So it has very similar syntax, and there's really no. There's a few new keywords in there, but it really looked like we create table as we always have done it, right? However, there are a few limitations there. The log data is not allowed. I think that's okay. Do you really want your XML data and your NVARCHAR max and your images and so on in your memory OLTP database? It's probably okay that that is set on disk, and you need to go down on disk and fetch that kind of data. So that's a limitation, all right? However, another limitation is that the row limit is of 8,060 bytes, and there's no off-row data as we know it with disk-based tables. So that means if you have a varchar 6,000 column, and you have another varchar 4,000 column, that's not going to fit on this limit within this 8,060 bytes. So SQL Server will bug at you and will throw you an error and say that cannot be done. And we do that when you create the table. So that's a limitation. I hope to see that in the future, that there will be off-row data somehow, but that's a limit, or they will increase this limitation, or they can kind of have the data split over multiple pages. But it's a limitation at the moment. The durability, there are two types of durability when you create the tables. There's something called schema and data, and that's a default one, which means that the data gets persisted on the disk. And then there's schema only, which means, well, the data, when SQL Server bounces, the data's gone. You're kind of like, what would you want that? Well, for temporary tables or some staging tables, that might actually be a good thing, because it would be very fast. It's all in memory. And you don't need to worry about that anything is written to the checkpoint files or anything is written to a transaction log or anything like that. So that's an example of where you might want to use the schema-only durability. A few more limitations. You can't have DML triggers. It's okay. One thing I really don't like is that you can't have foreign key constraints. That's a bit of worry to me, and I really hope they will implement that later on, maybe in CTP2 or in RTM, or even later on. Because if you don't have these constraints between your tables in your OLTP environments, I don't know how many of you are developers or DBAs, but if you have developers or are developers, do you always make those consistency checks in your application? Okay, someone up there is looking in the ceiling. So I guess the answer is no, right? I would really, really like that we could do check constraints. I would really, really like that we could have these foreign keys constraints in these memory-optimized tables. So Thomas is writing a note that to the product team that we need that. David said so. All right, cool. We can also we can't at the moment have any identity column. I believe that's a limitation in CTP1. So hopefully that will come as well. But the foreign key thing is hopefully will come. Then we have these indexes. We have indexes on the normal disk-based tables, as we know, and those are stored as B-trees. That's not the case when we talk about memory-optimized tables. Instead, they are stored as hash indexes, where you have a number of buffers, buckets, and it takes a key, and it hashes those keys into one of these buckets. If there are multiple keys that hashes to the same bucket, it will create a linked list between those records. So it'd be a bit slower to go down if everything matches the same bucket. All right. That's also why you need to specify how many buckets do you want in these hash keys when you're defining your index. And the number that you need to specify, the recommendation from Microsoft is that it should be larger or equal the expected cardinality of the index key column. Why is that? Well, we want more buckets, or at least the same a number of buckets, as unique values that we will have in the index key. Because we want, hopefully, that each key hashes to one bucket. That would be the fastest way. You don't want to create too many buckets, because each bucket takes up memory, and you will basically take up memory, become slower, you will have less performance. So you want, but you don't want to have too few buckets either, because then you end up with these linked lists, and then the index is kind of pointless, because if it needs to have one bucket, it needs to go through the linked list, it's kind of like a table scan, right? So it's you need to think about that. So there's a bit of design work to do that when you design these tables and are designing these hash indexes. How many buckets, how many rows are we expecting to have, how many unique rows on this primary key are we expecting to have in this memory-optimized table, right? So if you don't know that, that's good news. There's something called range index that I won't talk too much about because there's not too much material about it, and the reason for that is that it's not implemented in CTP1 yet. But it basically means that you don't need to tell SQL Server how many buckets are. Precisely how they implemented, I don't know, because, well, CTP-R is not, there's no white paper, so I haven't found any. Even Caelan Delaney's white paper says, well, we're going to talk about that in a later white paper when we have CTP2 coming out. All right. One really, really interesting fact about the indexes is that they are not stored on disk. They're not, well, the data is not stored on disk. Well, it is for the checkpoint files and for the transaction log, but the indexes are not stored on disk at all. And I think that's really, really cool because all the index operations, rebuilding of your indexes, inserting into the indexes and so on, is in memory. That means there's no overhead. You don't need to go down to disk and think about these things. The bad thing about that, or the flip side you can see, is that when SQL Server boots up, the more indexes you have on your tables, on your memory-optimized tables, the longer SQL Server takes to boot up, because it needs to go in and recreate those indexes on the fly. All right? So think about that when you're creating those indexes. You need at least one index on a memory-optimized table. If you're doing schema and data, that index needs to be the primary key. And you can have up to 8 indexes on a memory-optimized table at the moment. Whether or not they're going to expand that, 8 seems a little. I mean, it's a good number. If you want more, then yeah, we'll see that. So, but it's not stored on disk, and that's pretty cool, because you won't touch the disk, right? But you didn't come here to just see me talking, so let's try quickly dive into it a bit. So now we go into a demo. So where we'll look at how this actually works. We create a database, we create some tables and some indexes, and let's take a look at it, basically. Okay. This one will wake up. All right. Okay, we have a new query. Let's not do that. Bless you. I'll just drop this database. So probably had it when I was testing it. So we create a new database, and we create it with 3 file groups. So we create it with 1 primary file group and 1 a secondary file group, which we use for the disk-based data. Why would we want to create two file groups, not just have primary? Okay, let me ask you another. This is a question for you guys. Let me ask it another way. How many of you guys store your data in the primary file group? That's a couple of them. That's a really, really bad idea for those of you who do. Because when you're doing disaster recovery, you want to be able to bring on, especially if you're having enterprise, to bring on the primary file group with system tables, and then you can start loading off on your other file groups. So what I normally do is I try to keep primary, because the database can't come online unless the primary file group is online. So if you have terabytes and terabytes of data in your primary file group, it will take quite a long time for that file group to come online. But if you split it over multiple file groups, you can have the primary file groups, only the system tables come online like this. You have your hot data in one file group. Maybe you want your old your memory optimized data file group to come online first, because that's your hot data. That's what the users are waiting for when you have this disaster recovery. And then you can take your disk-based file groups and bring those online afterwards. If you store those disk-based in your primary, you need to wait for the primary file group to be able to come online, and if that's terabytes and terabytes of archive data, it's going to take a while before you can start bringing on your memory-optimized file groups. So think a little about that. That's just kind of out of scope for this session, but I want to think. Anyway, we create these three file groups. So we have the primary here. We have the secondary file group for our data, as we know it today. And then we have this new file group. This is with the new keywords that we have here, contains memory optimized data. And you can see, well, we give it a name as we did with a secondary file group there. We don't give it a size or max size or file group because it's not a file. It's a directory that you're specifying. So that's a bit different than we're used to. And that's because SQL Server stored these memory optimized tables a bit different than we're used to with a table with the disk space tables. And then we have the lock. Another thing here, which is really interesting, is that I'm setting the collation to a non-SQL bin 2 collation. How many are using this as a default collation for your databases? I certainly had never used that one before. The reason for that is that indexes on memory-optimized tables has to be on a columns using this collation. And also, when you're using natively compiled procedures, grouping and sorting and comparison, especially on string values, needs to be on this collation. I think it's probably something to do with how the data is stored in the structures, in the internals, that we need to use these. But I find it a little bit, it's not a problem. I just set it here on the database rather than go in and set it on the columns that we set up. Because you can kind of, if you have some columns that are strings, for example, that you want to use for comparison or something you want to use for grouping in your natal compile stored procedures, and you set the default collation as whatever you use to Danish, for example, case insensitive, accent sensitive, or whatever, then you would need to go in and set this collation within your stored procedures for these columns that you're doing it with and do this collation conversion. And so I don't know if it's best practice. There's not really much information out about the collation. Bob Buscherman have written a couple of blog posts, but he hasn't really come up with any recommendation of what to do. Just be careful about collations. So if you don't specify it here, you might end up with having to specify it in every single stored procedure that you're writing. All right. So let's try create this table and see what happens. Oh, not table, database, sorry. Yeah, we execute that one. Okay, so now we have... Okay, so this, never use primary for data for the user you do. Create another file group, you'll be much happier, your DBAs will be much happier once disaster happens. So let's just do that. Then we already added a file group for the memory optimized data. So we say, okay, well, like we can have as many file groups as we want for disk-based data. Let's try go in and say, let's add another file group for the memory optimized data. So we do that. Okay, SQL Server barks at us. Goes in and say, well, we can only have one of these memory optimized data file groups per database. So that's a limitation that you can't really split your data. Say, okay, well, we have some data that we want in this file group, or some data that we want in another file group. But the question is also really, do you want that when we're talking about memory optimized tables? Because your archive data, which is a really good thing to have your archive data on a different file group, or maybe even a read-only file group, but you probably don't want that to have that in memory in your memory-optimized data anyway. You probably want to have it on disk-based tables, maybe on a read-only file group, stored on some slow disk somewhere. All right. So I think this limitation, it's okay. I don't think it's really anything to worry about. So I only have that. But we can have multiple directories for these checksum files. Remember what I told you, can spread these checksum files across multiple LUNs. So I think that's really cool, because once you are in this disaster recovery and SQL Server needs to boot up and it needs to load all this data into memory, if they're spread across multiple LUNs on the SAN, well, it's only your HPA that's really the limit if you have enough spindles underneath. All right. So let's go in and do that. So let's try to take a look at how SQL Server goes in and actually stores these files there. So we can see here we have the primary file groups as we know it, we have the secondary file group as we know it, and we have the log file as we know it. But what is this? It's two new directories. So if we go into these, this is where SQL Server stores the memory optimized data. Let's try to go into that, and it's a file stream directory. We get the SKUIDs in there and go into them, and it's not really that readable to the human eye, is it? So that's okay, I think. I think it's okay that you can't go in and say, well, I mean, you have the directory. How SQL Server stores that, we'll probably see a bit more data coming out about that, or information coming out about that in some white papers, how it stores it internally. But I think it's interesting that it stores it in a directory, a file stream directory, rather than in a file. So let's try to take a look at the file groups. So we just use the database we just created, and we look at the sys data spaces. In here, we have the type FG as we know it already. And then we have this new file group that has an FX. So the DMVs, as we know it, have been extended to provide information about these new tables and this new data. And we can go into sys database files. And we can see here, well, we have a rows, this is a primary, we have a log file, the secondary file group, and then we have these two new file group, one file groups, but these two new files, not really files, it's file stream directories. So we saw that out in Explorer, how it was stored, it was file stream directories, and you can also see it here. Okay, it's correct. It was not us going insane. It is actually file stream directories that SQL Server is using that. So file streams we had since SQL Server 2008, and it's used those capabilities in the in-memory capabilities. And why not? I think it's pretty cool that they are actually using a feature that was designed for something else in storing these checkpoint files in for the memory optimized data. Okay, so now we have a database. Let's move on to create some tables. So we use the database and just create a schema just for the fun of it. So this is a syntax. So there we go. This is the new syntax. It looks very much like a create table like we're used to. But the employee ID, if you notice here, we create a primary key, which is a non-clustered hash index, and then we define the bucket size. Remember I talked about the bucket size, that you need to go in and define this bucket size and say, well, I think the cardinality, the unique entries in our primary key is going to be that much. And this bucket size is rounded up to 2 in something. So if you say, okay, I want the bucket size to be 50,000, it would be rounded up to 65,000 something, right? So you need to go in there. The employee ID cannot be nullable. So these indexes that we're creating does not support null values. So bear that in mind. Like the same goes for the name. We see we create another index that called IXName, which is a non-clustered hash index. And if you look at the name column, it cannot be null. It can also not be an identity column for the primary key, but I believe that will come on in CDB2 or RTM or something like that. So that's pretty cool. And then you have these will memory on and the durability. So the will memory optimized on is how you define that this is a memory optimized table. The durability, if you don't define durability equals schema and data, the default is schema and data, so it would just create a schema and data. But you can define here that it should be a schema only. All right. So let's try that. Okay, so we created this. So now we want to add another column to this table that we have created. So we go in and we do that. We want this job description for the employee to be added there. And SQL Server barks at us. We cannot use an alter table to make schema changes to our tables. This is a limitation. So if you want to add new columns, if you want to go in and add a new column or drop a column or change the data type or whatever you want to do, maybe you want to say, okay, well, this one cannot be allowed null while it was nullable before, you need to go in and drop the table and recreate it. So it's quite, as a DBA, that's not something I would be very happy about having to do if you have a lot of data on these. All right? So you need to move around the data, create another table, move the data over there, and so on. I really, really hope that this is something that Microsoft will go in and they'll say, well, we're going to support these alter tables. So we must drop the table, and we create the table now with our job description. That's a varchar max. Okay. SQL Server counts that. The type varchar max is not supported, remember. Varchar max is a lob column, remember? So remember what I said? It's not supported. You can't have XML columns. You can't have varchar max images and so on in there. So I think that's fair enough because do you really want your entire lolcat collection in memory in there somewhere, whatever you fancy, all right? So that's fair enough. So let's create a varchar 8000 instead. Maximum we can want as big one because we have a very long job description that we want to add to these ones. So let's do that. So now we create it now with a job description as a varchar 8000. SQL Server barks at me again. The row size limit of 8060 bytes for memory optimized table has been exceeded. Please simplify the table definition. Simplify, okay. Because we added this 8000 and we already have a name that is a varchar 200, we already have a title that is varchar 100, we have an integer, and we have a date, we simply exceeded that maximum. So something that you need to be a bit careful about if you're migrating your application or your data structures to this memory optimized tables is that maybe, probably, it's going to exceed that limit. You might have to narrow your data types a bit. Or you might have to split it, do horizontal partitioning all of a sudden, and have some data in one table, another table, and then a key that combines these two. Both of them can be memory-optimized tables, so you can have one that's memory-optimized tables and another one that is a disk-based table, for example. You can do these kind of things. But it's just something to bear in mind when you're designing these applications that there is this limit. All right? Okay, so let's limit us to 8,060 bytes. So now we go in and we create with a job description of 7,700 bytes. And that should be all right. And SQL Server is happy. So I'm happy. All right. Oops. Fair enough. However, a better solution might actually to be, because 7,800, is that really enough for a job description? A better solution might actually be, okay, well, these job descriptions is not something we go in and update or read every day. We want it stored in our database, but it's not something that we go in and say, well, this needs to be this fast in memory all the time. So a better solution might actually be to go in and say, let's just take that data and split it out to a disk-based table and have a reference, a key column that reference that table, and we can go out and read that via the interop via T-SQL. So that might be a better solution. There's a blog post there. I'll put this online so you don't need to. It's a very long one. Maybe I should use Bitly. That talks a bit about these things, about different solutions, about how you can store log data with your in-memory. And this is one of the solutions. This is a simple solution, is that you can take the log data and just kind of split it out to a disk-based table. And then have your memory-optimized table where you have the non-log values. Another way that he describes this guy is that you simply take this log data and you kind of split it into multiple rows. And then you have a stored procedure that goes in, and whenever you insert something, you use this stored procedure, natively stored procedure, to go in and take the varchar max column and split it into, for example, 8,000 bytes at a time, so it fits in there, and when you want to read it again, you have another stored procedure that you go in and it goes in and combines this data. Then you will have it in memory, but you kind of need to think a little about, you can't just go, okay, select star from blah. All right, so it's a solution, but I actually like it a little better to just say, okay, fair enough. It's the job description. We'll store that on disk rather than store it in memory. So, but there is a solution for it. So we create this table with a job description. And notice here we now create it on our secondary file group, which is a disk-based file group. So just as we normally do it. And this one has the job description ID. And then we go and drop and recreate, as we can't do an alter. And we add this job description ID as an integer, which is a reference. In there, we go in and we add the foreign key to it. Did I drop it? I didn't, did I? No, I didn't. Let's drop it and then add it again. Just same structure, except we add this ID with a reference to our new table. And SQL Server comes down and barks at me again. And then the feature foreign key constraints is not supported with memory optimized tables. That worries me. Especially because it doesn't say it's not yet implemented in CTP1. As other things say, it says it's not supported. And you really need to, if you're a DBA, you need to stand on the neck of your app developers and say, okay, you better make sure that the consistency is all right in your application if you're dealing with these things. If you're a developer, now is the time to start thinking about it if you want your data in these memory-optimized tables. So, fair enough. Let's move on. Okay, then. So, yeah, we just created now with a job description, without any foreign keys, and that should work. And it does. That worked, yay. I had very much fun when I wrote these demos, as you can see. So, We can also now create one, as a talk with durability as schema only. Remember I talked a little bit about that you can normally you have the schema and data where data get persistent on disk with the checksum files and uses a transaction log as well. Well, we can have also that the schema only where none of that happens. It's only the schema that gets persisted on disk. So when SQL Server reboots, you have the disaster, all the data is gone, but the schema is still there. You use that for staging. I believe one of you guys up there has something about BI. There was something about staging maybe in there. Jens is nodding, so that's cool. That's tomorrow where you're going to talk. But I'll just show that you can actually create these things. So we just create this one. It's just a staging table. Maybe we want to load the data into that one. We want to do some updates on it. We want to do it all in memory. We don't care about if we lose this data before we actually maybe do an update into our existing or do a merge or something like that. Not that merge is supported, but we could write our own, right? So let's try take a look at sys tables. And we have now these three tables. We have one here that is disk-based. We have the memory one optimized table, where, and you see this new flag that is memory optimized. And we have this durability description where it says it stores the schema and data and it stores the schema only. So that's additional information that we now are getting from the sys tables DMVs. I really like that they just expanded the current DMVs that all of us know. And we can just see, okay, well, give me the new information that I want. Also a bunch of new DMVs, and it was basically just a list of them when I looked in the white paper, and I was like, okay, well, I can spend a couple of days trying to figure all these out, or I can just wait until someone describes them for me. They are on books online, but it's really, some of this stuff is yeah, well, we're in CTP1, all right? So we can also look at this new DMV has indexes, and we can see, well, on our employee table, in a memory-optimized table, we have the primary key and we have this IX name. One thing I really forgot to mention before, is in this staging table, there's no need for a primary key. No need for a primary key when we have this schema only. There's only need for a primary key when we have schema and data. So I think that's pretty cool, but you still need one index at least, because that's how. There's no such things as heaps in memory-optimized tables. So, great. So that we took a look at the hash index, didn't we? Yes, we did. So we see here it doesn't have a primary key; it just only has a new index, and it has a new index type, which is 7. So remember, cluster index is 1, and then 2 for non-cluster, and don't remember the rest. All right. So that was a bit of a demo about that. Let's go back to the presentation. So now that we have some database, now that we have some tables, we also want to do something with this data. So we can go in and we can select, we can insert, we can update, and we can delete as we usually are used to. And that's really cool. There's no new language. It's not like we need, like when they made tabular model, we need to learn DAX. Here, it's T-SQL. I'm so happy about that. I can't express that happiness, really. So it's almost transparent to the users whether or not they're working on memory-optimized tables or disk-based tables. And that's really cool. Because the client application, they go through this TDS handler. Remember, I had this slide before. Like, it goes through the TDS handler, and then the TDS handler says, well, I'll figure out if we need to go down and access it via the memory-optimized tables, or we need to go and access the buffer pools as we're used to. If it's an interpreted T-SQL query, it goes down and says, well, maybe I'm accessing both, so I need to go down via that one and then use the interop to go down and access the memory-optimized data. And tables and indexes. I really think Microsoft, it's so cool. It's really, really cool. I'm sorry, I'm getting all psyched up here, but I really think that's a cool thing. You don't need a second interface. So, yeah, you have these interop capabilities I talk about where you can access the memory from T-SQL, interpreted T-SQL. So let's try to take a look at this. I told you there was going to be a lot of demos here. Okay, we all know Select. Northwind. I bet you all know Northwind, right? So Microsoft took, they didn't take AdventureWorks, they took Northwind, a very old database, and said, let's publish that as a memory optimized database. So that's what we're using, get it on TechNet. So let's try to take a look at what tables do we have in this one. I made a few changes to it, but you can see here there's a bunch of tables. Some of them are memory optimized, and some of them are not. All right? They all have schema and data. There's no schema only in there. Fair enough. We set statistics IO on because we want to see are we actually reading something. I need to remember to turn on SharePlan. I always put this in the demo because otherwise I forget and I'm like, huh? What am I supposed to show here, right? So bear in mind that there might be notes in these demos that's just for me. Let's just drop the clean buffers in the buffer pool just to make it fair. So let's try. First, we run them one at a time. Very simple. Just take orders on disk. That's a disk-based table, hence the name created. So let's just try to take a look at that. We have mentions, we have the order disk, we have some logical reads, we have one physical read, we have a few reader head reads, and so on. So that is, as we know it today, as we expect it, when we go down and we read this data. If I run it again, there's probably not going to be any physical reads or reader reads. We can just run it again just to see that. It's only just because now all the data is in the buffer pool, right? So it's in memory, but SQL Server doesn't know it's in memory. So the optimizer goes down and say, well, I think it's not in memory. So I'll make my query plan as if the data is not in the buffer pool. Fair enough. Let's try for the memory. Okay, that's kind of a spoiler alert. There are no logical reads. That's not even an output saying anything. It just kind of ignores my statistics I own and says, well, I don't care about I.O. I'm in memory. All right? So, that's fair enough. I mean, we're doing that. So let's try run both of them at the same time and look at the execution plan. So now we run both of them and we look at the execution plan here. The first one here is the orders on disk compared to the other one. Look at this. And this is the orders in memory. It's significantly faster to have it in memory. This is very small data, obviously. But there are some benchmarks that people have made. Microsoft has some cases out there that show this is really, really fast. Because it's all in memory. The query optimizer knows it's all in memory. It does not need to go, and well, it's probably on disk. I need to cater for that and make a query plan that I don't know if it's in the buffer pool or not. So I think it's so cool. You can see here, well, let me just zoom out and zoom in again. See here, well, up here we read the clustered index, but down here, non-clustered hash. Okay, I kind of drew over that. But non-clustered hash, that's the new indexes that we created for this one. So the query plans actually know all about this, and that's really cool. We also go in and see, well, here we have, I didn't have that there, did I? Maybe it's down here. There we go. We have the storage here. It goes down and say, this table is a memory optimized table. So in the query plans, you can go in and say, while it for the user and the app developer might be transparent whether or not these tables are memory-based, memory-optimized tables or disk-based tables, you can via the execution plan. Sorry, via the execution plan, go in and see that as a developer whether or not it's a disk-based or a memory-optimized table. Okay. We continue with some inserts. We use the Northwind database here. And we just create, I have this orders on disk, which is a disk-based table, and we have the orders, which is a memory host, and I created a bunch of indexes also. So we have, it's not the same indexes as this has indexes on the memory-based, and it's some clustered and some non-clustered indexes, B-trees on the disk-based table, but it's the same on the same columns, it's the same indexes that you can see here. We have a primary key in both of them, and we have some non-clustered indexes here on our disk based table, and we have some non-clustered hash indexes here. So just to make it fair comparison between the two. So what I want to show you now is what is happening in a transaction log when we do operations to our table. All right. So what is the difference in our transaction log? What is the impact to our transaction log when we insert a row into our orders table, whether or not that order table is memory optimized or table disk-based? So let's try to take a look at that. How can we do that? So there's a lot of code here. So try to distract a little about all the things that goes on where we declare, we get a transaction ID. I just didn't want to get duplicates, so I'm just getting the next order ID because we can't have an identity column on the in-memory tables. This is the actual insert, where we insert a row into our orders on disk, in this case, so disk-based table. And then we just take that transaction ID, we store that, we commit the transaction, and we use FNDB log. If you haven't used that, it's really cool. You can go down and read what's happening in transaction log. We go down and we read that one from that explicit transaction where we just did this insert. So everything else doesn't matter. It's just this transaction. So let's try to do that and see what is happening in the transaction log when we do this insert. I need to scroll a little bit. There we go. And we can go in here, and it does a few inserts. Well, we only inserted one row. Yes, but it inserted into the clustered index, and it inserted a row to each of the non-clustered indexes as well at the leaf level. All right. That's fair enough. Let's try the same with the order table, which is the memory optimized table. So the exact same thing, query running just for the memory optimized. And let's try to take a look at that. Significantly less impact on the transaction log. Why is that? It's a question. Remember that I said that indexes are always stored in memory, they're never stored on disk. That also means when we insert a row, SQL Server doesn't care about having to make entries in the transaction log for the non-clustered hash indexes. So here we just have the begin transaction, and we have this lob hegatron, I would say, and we have the commit transaction. While in the other one, we had an insert for both the clustered index and for each of the non-clustered indexes. That's very small footprint compared to our disk-based tables when you have a lot of non-clustered indexes. Okay, fair enough. What happens if we then do this transaction, the explicit transaction where we insert the row and roll back? Let's try to take a look at that. This is where I get psyched again. So, do this exact same thing, except we do this rollback now instead of a commit. So let's try that. Now it's 16 rows because first it goes in and does the insert row. And then it goes down and it inserts a delete row afterwards. So it does the undo redo kind of thing and makes sure and it's marked as ghost. So the ghost cleanup background process would go in and clean those rows up at some point in time. It's quite a large footprint despite the fact that we roll back the transaction. Is this what is going to happen when we are doing this with memory optimized tables? Let's try to take a look. Any difference? I know it's early in the morning, but let's try to get a vote on this one. What will happen? We had one, well, we had three entries before. Remember, we had a begin transaction, we had the where it actually inserted a row, and we had a commit transaction. So when we do the rollback, will we have an insert and delete? How many things that will happen?
I don't think we'll have anything.
You don't think you will have anything? How many things we don't have anything? Most of you. Awesome, because that's exactly what is happening there. So I think that is so cool. Because there's no footprint, we don't care about the transaction log before we actually start committing the data. So when we do the commit, it inserts something into a transaction log for recovery purpose. But if we're in an open transaction and SQL Server go boom, do we really care about that open transaction or not? Probably not. So why should we have that in the transaction log, right? And in our checksum files, we have the old value anyway. In this case, not this row. So I think that's really cool. So let's just do a quick with the update. I'll use the Northwind database here. Just want to show you the difference in the execution. Exact same update where you set the ship date for Hitachi here as a customer. So, and I have to remember to turn on show plan, otherwise it would be a quite boring demo. And you see the difference here. One thing that's really a thing, the first one is the memory optimized data. The table update costs 5% of the execution, while the clustered index update, because it needs to go down and write at the disk, costs 75%. That also means that over here, we now have, because our index strategy is pretty bad, we actually have an index seek, and we need to go down and do a key lookup. So that's, we're not really happy about that. While up here, we can see it's just an index seek on this hash. Because that index is an index seek. It needs to go. It has everything, basically. It's in memory. It doesn't care about need to do key lookup and all this stuff. But another thing here, sorry if you're getting dizzy for the zooming in and out. The cost of these two updates. It's a very small query, very small database, and so on. But I think it's cool. It goes like this, right? So, that's pretty cool. Okay, let's go back to... Yeah. So let's try to take a look at logs. And I'll go about... So we're apparently not talking as fast as I thought I would. So let's talk a little bit about logs. Because SQL Server for these memory-optimized tables, for the in-memory component, use what's called an optimistic multi-version concurrency control. What does that mean? It basically means that there's no lock. There's no locks acquired when you read the data. There's no locks acquired when you update the data. Right? So that means there's no waiting because of locking. It also means, because it's all in memory, there's no wait for reading the data from the disk. It also means it doesn't need to go down and lock the rows on the disk and do latches and all that stuff. So, however, if a transaction inserts a row with the same key as another open transaction does, SQL Server will throw you an error. It's kind of like a deadlock. You have to think about this as a deadlock. It's not really a deadlock, because that works differently. But it's kind of, if you're unlucky about this, and remember, we don't have identity columns, so they can't save you. You need to work out the keys yourself. So if that happens, you throw an error, and your application needs to handle that. Just like your application needs to handle deadlock if those occurred. Hopefully, you designed your application so this will not happen. Just like you designed your application as deadlock will not happen. Same goes if a transaction updates the same row as another open transaction has just updated. SQL Server go in and it will throw you an error. All right? So let's try to take a look at that. So we use the Northwind here. And we begin, make an explicit transaction. Begin that one. And we go in here and we update. And we have to do this with snapshot because we can only use read committed if it's an auto commit transaction for some reason. So that's a limitation. Anyway, so we go in and here and we update this orders table. This is the in-memory based table. And let's try to see if there's any logs to that. None whatsoever. Well, there are two logs. There's a shared database log and a schema shared on the table. That's fair enough, I think. But there's no like intent exclusive locks or on the row. There's no exclusive locks on the pages or anything like that when we're doing this. No locks, really. So there's new DMV where we can go in and we can see these things. And we have this new DMV that goes and lists a transaction. It tells you a bunch of stuff, which is, and we can see we have an active transaction which is in progress. So that's how much I could read out of this. There's a bunch of other stuff that I'm like, okay, well, we have a thread ID and so on. But I'm sure this is going to be documented much, much better once we get closer to RTM. Then we go down and we update a row on the disk-based table. And then we go and take a look at our logs. All of a sudden now we have logs on the pages and 10 extent log on the pages. We have exclusion logs on a couple of keys here on the rows. So this is how we normally do it with our disk-based tables in recommit, right? So this is just as expected. So let's try run the second. So remember, we have an open transaction where we updated these two tables, all right? Just one row. We open a second one here. And this is implicit transactions. Normally, we would get blocked when we do this on a disk-based table. But now we're accessing the same row that we have just updated for Hitachi as the custom ID. And we're accessing that for the memory-optimized table. Let's see what happens. And we get that row. We get it with the old value, because the transaction has not been committed in transaction one. But we can access this as no logs. That's cool. And we go down and we do the same thing for our disk-based. And it just kind of hangs there. Because now our transaction one is blocking transaction two, because it has acquired logs in this. So I really think this no locking thing is a really benefit when you're dealing with these kind of things, because you don't need to wait for that. There's no blocking transactions. It's only if you try to write to the same row at the same time that you have been in trouble. But there's no writers blocking readers here. And that's really, really cool. I get psyched about that again. Okay? Then we run the third one here. Use the Northwind. And then we first do it for the... We make an explicit transaction. We update the memory-based table there. So let's try to do that. SQL Server barks at us. Why does it do that? So this is the error 41302. That's the one you need to handle in your application. That means we are going down in transaction one and saying, well, I'm updating this row with Hitachi. And in transaction three here, I say, I want to update the same row. SQL Server says, well, that you cannot do because there's already an open transaction that is going down and updating that row. Because of this, no locking, it doesn't go down and have to wait for the other transaction to finish, to commit or roll back before it can update this one, like we are used to. It just says, well, you can't do that. So that's something that you need to be careful about when you're designing your application, is you need to handle this error and say, okay, fair enough, I'll wait 5 seconds or something, and I'll try update again, for example. So bear that in mind. That's why you can't just take your current application and its current data structure and just think, okay, fair enough, I'll port it to memory optimized and we'll all be happy. Because this might happen. You don't have the identity column. You need to handle the keys yourself. And you probably might have, if it's a web-based thing, an order system or something, you might have two people working on the same order at the same time. You're used to saying, well, we need to wait for the other person to finish. Now it says, well, there's another person working. Come back later. All right? So I think it's fair enough because of this no locking thing. And I really like that there's no locking. No. Okay, what happens then if we do it for the disk-based one? Well, I kind of did a spoiler alert before, because that one just hangs again. Because we have the open transaction, and this writer is blocking the writer. It's also blocking the reader. Writers block readers, writer block writers, usually in recommitted. But not with memory-optimized tables. So we go back to the first one here and say, okay, fair enough, well, we really didn't want to do that. I'm sorry. Let's try doing a rollback. And the two other one, this one returns. This goes bang. We're done waiting. This is the disk-based one. And the first one says, fair enough, I'm done updating. So let's just roll this back. Otherwise, I might be in trouble. Okay, the end. The last thing I just want to briefly talk about is natively compiled stored procedures, which is a new thing as well, where instead of having to interpret this T-SQL language every time we execute it, it gets compiled and stored as machine code. Sorry. So how you can access the memory optimized table from T-SQL using this interop. So that means if you're doing ad hoc queries, you probably don't want to have that ad hoc queries and store those as natively stored procedures and never use them again. You probably want just to run it as T-SQL. And the engine will go down fair enough. We use the interop to go down and access the memory optimized tables. If you want to access both the memory optimized table and the disk table, you need to use T-SQL again. You can't use these natively compiled stored procedures because it's a one-way street. So you need to use T-SQL again, and we use the interop to go down. I need the data from here and the data from here, and we combine that. And that's transparent to the user whether or not the tables are disk-based or memory optimized. However, the best execution performance is if you use these natively compiled stored procedures. I haven't done some benchmarking on this, but there has been some benchmarking out there, and it's significant improvements that you get with that. You can read up about that on the net. So, because the native compiled stored procedures, they can only access the memory optimized tables and not the other way around. So let's try to take a look at that. Last demo before we round off. So, just drop the stored procedure if I already have it. This is from the Northwind database. I didn't bother writing my own stored procedure for this. So you can see here there's some new keywords here. We have the native compilation. We need to do schema binding, otherwise it won't work. SQL Server say, well, you can't do that. That's because you cannot drop a table, for example, a memory optimized table, that you have a stored procedure that is natively compiled to access that. All right? You can do that with a normal T-SQL procedure, but can't do that with a natively compiled stored procedures. You have to explicitly say execute as owner, execute as self, or execute as user, some user. There's no execute as caller. One thing I didn't manage to test before today was whether or not this would probably break ownership chaining. And that's something I want to test about. And that's a limitation as well. And I can't say whether or not this is a good or bad thing before I tested it. You do this begin atomic will. You set the action isolation level to snapshot. Recommit is not allowed in natively compiled stored procedures. That's a long word. And for some reason, you have to set a language. So I believe that has something to do with the bin2 collation that we talked about earlier. But I'm not too sure. A lot of unknowns when we're talking about this. This is CTP1, there's like one white paper out there and a few blog posts here and there, and it's not that much. Let's just create this one. All right. We turn on execution plan. And there's no execution plan. We turned it on. There's no execution. It's not just me who didn't forget it. You see here, we turned it on, right? So, believe it's something that will get fixed. Hopefully. Or maybe it's just because, well, this is completely different. It's a native compile. There's no query optimizer as we used to. Or does it a new query optimizer? Exactly how it does, I don't know. But it's just something. Let's try something a little different, a little more fun than just the stored procedure up there. This one up here, sorry, was just like a select from orders, right, where the custom ID. Let's do a little more fun here with some sun and convert to money and a date name, and we join two tables, both are memory optimized, and see what happens. We execute this one, and SQL Server barks at us again. The function date name is not supported with native compiled stored procedures. All right. Did not work. What do we do? Well, we use the interop and we create a normal stored procedure where we do this. It will be a bit slower than the natively compiled stored procedure, but okay, I didn't drop the other one. Let me just try to do that. There was already one in there. Got too eager, that's why. So let's just try again. There we go. Creates us, we're all happy about it. We have the execution plan on. And we can say now we have the execution plan. Didn't have that with a native compile stall procedures, but we do have that when we're using the interop. So, all right. So let's try a little bit where we access both a memory optimized table and a disk tape table, and we do this as a native compile stall procedure. And SQL Server goes down and says, okay, we can't do that. We cannot access employee photos because it's a disk-based table. We cannot do that. It's a one-way street. That's a no-go. All right. That didn't work. So we do again. Well, just as a T-SQL, a normal stored procedure, it uses the interop to go down and access the in-memory data. And there we go. Have this one. What's really interesting is here that we have an index seek on the employees and a clustered index seek on the photos. And you see here the storage. That was what I tried to show you earlier. It didn't show up. And the storage, it's a row store for the disk-based one. And you can go down here and you can say, well, this one, oops, this is a memory-optimized one. So you can actually in your show plan see which one. You can also kind of see that, well, this is a clustered index. This one goes down and accesses a non-clustered hash. So that kind of reveals that we're talking about an in-memory there. The end. Let's go back to the presentation. Oops. Let's try that. I know we're about to run out of time. So that's fine, because this is a summary slide. So we talked a bit about today. And this was the purpose of this talk, was just not to give you the marketing stuff. Not to give you, this is the greatest thing in the world. I think it's a really great thing in the world. But I also want to show you kind of what are the limitations, what hasn't been implemented yet. I believe a lot of the stuff will be resolved before RTM. And I really hope that. And Thomas, I've written down my foreign key thing, because I really hope that one will get in there, if it does, or at least at a later stage. We talked a little about how you can create, we showed you how you can create databases, checkpoint files, and transaction logs, and so on. Talked you a little bit about how that works. Need to be worrying about the recovery time. You need to split out, like on multiple launch, your checkpoint files, because when SQL Server bounces, that's going to take some time to load the data up into memory if you have a lot of data. Showed you a little about how you create the tables, how you create the indexes, and the DML is select, insert, and delete, and update, and so on. Talked a little bit about locks, so there's no locking. And you have this error if you do have two, that one transaction that has updated one row and the other transaction, and this one is open, the other transaction try to update the same row, SQL Server will throw you an error, and you need to handle that in your application. Same goes to the insert if you're trying to insert with the same key. And then talked briefly about the natively compiled stored procedures, which supposedly are going to be a lot faster to execute, especially if you have a lot of logic in these stored procedures, but you define them as T-SQL, and I really think that's fantastic. Because you don't need to write C-sharp or CLR or what do you know? It's T-SQL, it's fantastic. We know that language by heart, we dream in it. Some of us do. All right. Bunch of references. I put this up on my blog. I don't expect you guys to write these down. There's a few of these. The first one here is the white paper. It's really good. It kind of shows the internals. The second one here is the Data Platform Insider. It's a TechNet blog, and it has a category called In Memory, and it has a bunch of stuff out there. It's fantastic. So go read those blog posts. If you're really geeky like me, you go read the research paper on Hackathon. And I go like, oh, that blows my mind. And then there's a bunch of other stuff. Don't forget to do your evaluation on me, on everybody else. We're very old school, so we do it via SMS, and everybody pulls out the phone. So this is DB303 and 35s, please. And then we want foreign keys, something like that. Thank you very much. This is my blog. If anybody's interested, I put up the slides there. I believe this one will be online as well in a couple of days. If there's any questions, I think we are out of time. Otherwise, come up. I think there's half an hour break. There's lunch break and so on. I'll be around. So thanks a million for coming today.